The new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator, relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for over-serving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
I saw a post this week on social media posted by attorney Peter Tragos, host of Lawyer You Know podcast and YouTube. The quote is from John H. Wigmore, and it reads, quote, "Cross-examination is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth," end quote. There's no better quote to start off this episode with, because just about this entire episode is going to be centered around one person.
Jen!
Almost exactly 1 year has passed since Jen McCabe took the stand in Karen Reed's last trial. And it's hard not to notice that some things have changed, and some things have stayed the same. For example, a lot of Jen's direct testimony pretty much stayed the same. John was a good friend of hers. She didn't see John enter the house. She thought it was so incredibly weird that Karen Reed did not take her shoes off when they got to John's as they're frantically trying to find him. That was a rule of his, after all. And there are some things that changed. For example, Jen's appearance, her demeanor, and her apparent new inability to recall if she Googled anything or what time that happened. And while some things changed and some things remain the same, one thing's for sure. Jen McCabe made a solid effort to learn from her experience on the stand last time. Direct examination is usually the easier part for most witnesses. You're answering questions for the attorney who called you there, and under most circumstances, the witness knows exactly what to expect, and they're kind of walked through testimony by an attorney who isn't trying to pick them apart. And that was the case with Jen McCabe. Jen was called to the stand on day 6, right after Ian Whiffen, who had just testified about Jen's Google search. Now, like I said, Jen's appearance is noticeably different. She's very tan, new hair, new huge cross necklace hanging around her neck, but along with her appearance, Jen's demeanor has also had a huge makeover. She's softer, not as combative during cross, and incredibly apologetic. I lost count at how many times she said, "I'm sorry." Jackson even pointed it out at one point, asking if someone had coached her to say that so often. It was clear from the start that Jen McCabe was very aware of how she was being perceived, and it seemed like she was really playing up the soccer mom thing.
Yeah, so I was a teacher, and then once I had children, I stayed at home with them and basically was just kind of like your typical, I don't know, small town mom. I was the room parent. I coached them. When I coached, I drove the kids back and forth on my team, would take them places, etc.
Jen also talked about going into mom mode to help everyone and looked at the jury again the next day as she explained, she's just a normal mom. She's not used to this. Jen walks through direct testimony with Brennan. She describes the events leading up to Waterfall, who was there, says everyone was in a celebratory mood, and she was happy to see John and Karen when they arrived. She said she was friends with John, but she didn't really hang out with Karen unless John was there. She liked Karen, but they weren't friends. She didn't even have her phone number, but she liked her. Now, they get ready to leave Waterfall, and Jen invites Karen and John to Fairview. Karen initially declines, but of course, they do end up going. So Jen gives directions on the phone to John using Bella's mom's house as a landmark. Later on, clips are played for the jury of Karen confirming this in an interview. This is part of Brennan's theory on motive. Once at Fairview, Jen says she's hanging out, listening to music, and sees a dark SUV out front, straight in front of the house. She looks out again at one point and notices it had moved up further toward the flagpole. She says the first two texts that she sent were each of those times she looked outside. She said she probably looked a few other times, but nobody came inside. She texted a few more times, called, and never saw Karen or John after that. Now, she left, had peanut butter and bread in her back seat. When they got home, Matt made a snack. She went up to her room, looked up some basketball stuff, and then put the phone down and went to sleep. Very specific details and memories, right? She woke up the next morning at 4:53 a.m., very specific about that time, to Kaylee's phone calling her. She heard Karen screaming in the background. They hang up, Karen calls back, and Jen tells the same story that she and her husband Matt both told last year, which was the first anyone had ever heard this story. She said Karen told her that her taillight was cracked while they were on the phone, and she says that Karen just showed up at her house. She said Karen was screaming, and her husband Matt said, tell her to shut up. She was going to wake up the neighbors. Carrie shows up over there, and they all go to John's. Karen doesn't take her shoes off, and they head toward Fairview. On the way, Karen asks if John O'Keefe could be at Bella's mom's house, and when they get to Fairview, Karen sees John first. She kicks the door, gets out of the car, and runs toward him, at which point Carrie looks over at Jen.
Carrie looks at me and said she's batshit crazy.
Jen describes what she can see. More on that in a minute. And she calls 911, telling them there's a man unresponsive in the snow. They asked her if she's comfortable doing CPR, and she said she doesn't feel comfortable doing CPR. She thinks he's already dead. She took over chest compressions for Carrie, and then the officers arrive, then EMT. Karen was running around. They take John away on the stretcher, and Karen keeps screaming and repeating, is he dead, and could I have hit him? She asked her to Google how long to die of hypothermia, and we get to something I can only describe as a performance here. Now look, I'm going to go back over all of this more in detail, but a lot of this we've already been over in the last 49 episodes. Besides, remember that quote I started the episode with? But anyway, when we get to this part of the direct examination, Jen is describing the Google searches for the jury, and this is what she says.
I think as I entered it, I misspelled things. And so then I think I tried a second search. And again, I don't think I even paid attention to what came up.
She thinks she may have misspelled some things as if she doesn't know. And we haven't all been going over this for 2 years now. But the jury doesn't know what we know. So I can't help but wonder if this was effective for them. Jen goes on to say that Karen said, I hit him, I hit him, I hit him to an EMT, and she interrupted her because she thought she was talking crazy. Brennan asked, were you looking out for her? And Jen said, yes. Jackson objected, obviously, and it was stricken from the record, but Brennan asking leading questions has become a common theme here. He's basically testifying himself in many situations, feeding the answers that he's looking for to witnesses to mold his narrative for the jury. Another thing Brennan makes a point to do during direct examination is to clear up some loose ends from last year. I'll give you a few examples. Last year, the 911 call that Jen made ignited a social media firestorm when people heard Jen McCabe tell the dispatcher in kind of a flat tone, there's a man passed out in the snow. Now, that got a lot of attention, with people questioning why Jen would refer to John O'Keefe as a guy if that's her close friend. And Brennan asked her about this, and she said she was trying to be as calm as she could and just give the most specific details she could. She felt like a man is a better and more detailed description than giving that man's name, John O'Keefe, or letting them know he's an officer. Now, another example is the Google search. Previously, Jen mentioned being in the back of the police cruiser when this happened, but the audio would have caught it, so that was, of course, heavily questioned. So this year, aside from the, oh gee, maybe I misspelled stuff, Jen also made a point to say that they were in the back of the cruiser and then stepped out, and that's when Karen asked her. Then there's the issue of going into her sister's house and waking them up. This one was kind of a bizarre change. So listen to how it was described last year.
Well, at some point between 6 and 6:30 that morning, my sister Jennifer came bursting into my bedroom. She was hysterical.
My sister-in-law, Jen, had burst into my room. She was very upset, almost hysterical.
So that's Jen's sister, Nicole Albert, and her husband, Brian Albert. And Jen also described bursting into their room, but it became an issue on cross-examination last year.
And you said you burst into the door into a dark room where they were sleeping, correct?
Yes.
Mr. Albert said that you were somewhat hysterical. Did you agree with that?
Yes.
You were loud, right?
I was trying to wake them up.
You were somewhat chaotic.
Yes.
And you don't remember a 70-pound German Shepherd having any reaction?
No.
So after everyone agreed last year that Jen came bursting into the room, now that story has changed. Take a listen.
And I think I knocked on their door.
Bedroom door?
Their bedroom door. And then I opened the door. I went in and I walked over to the bed and I was like, Brian, Nicole. Because I was in a position where I felt like the world was going on around me. So much was happening. But I also was aware that I was just about to wake up two people that are sound asleep, and they're going to see me standing over their bed and be startled, wondering, what am I doing here?
So what happens?
So it took a minute or two, and then Brian woke up, and he immediately was like startled and was like, Jennifer, what's going on? What are you doing?
But here's the thing. This is a weird thing to change. Brian and Nicole both said they remember you burst into their room. You said you did. Everyone heard you did, and now the story is that you're so aware of your surroundings that you knocked first, then walked in, and it took you a few minutes to wake them up because you were being careful since you knew that they would be startled. The only reason I can think that this story would change and all of a sudden have these fancy new details and a totally different theme are the questions about Chloe not going crazy. There's one other example I wanted to give you. Jen was shown dash cam video where she pointed out who was who, including the female EMT and Officer Seraph. Another big issue in last year's testimony was Seraph saying he never heard Karen say, I hit him. But the female EMT said that Karen said it in front of him. Brennan stops the dash cam video at a time when Seraph turns his back and asks if this is the time that Karen is saying this. And another thing, he asks about her being in shock in her initial interviews, kind of explaining away why Jen didn't give some of these key statements in those first interviews, like the cracked taillight or Karen asking, could I have hit him? Brennan's line of questioning seemed to heavily rely on his experience as a defense attorney, because it was kind of like he was predicting all of the issues that could come up in cross-examination and trying to tackle them in direct. Another interesting moment on direct examination came when we heard Jen talking about going to John's house on the 29th, where she said his family was gathered, along with loved ones and friends, and someone else.
Describe the traffic and the people that were there.
There was a house full of family, friends, coworkers, loved ones. the car repairman, like anyone and everyone.
Did you ever see the defendant?
No.
Here's why this fueled a fire. There has long been speculation about working to have damage to John's car fixed very soon after Karen backed into it. Now, to be clear, you can't see any damage on the car in the Ring video. Although I do understand the Ring video is difficult to see. But of all people for Jen to randomly throw out there that was at the house that day, this one was one that people definitely noticed. Now, Jen says they left the O'Keefes and just kind of swung by Lanks to drop off Carrie's daughter. No biggie. Well, no biggie just yet, but we'll circle back to that. And she tells us about Mrs. O'Keefe wanting her and Carrie to create a timeline, which they did. Now, overall, a lot of what we've heard before, with some things that have changed around some and some new details added in, which isn't usually too strange. I will say, in this case, the details added in are very convenient, but that could just be because she wanted to make it clearer since she was questioned so heavily on some of these things last time. Now, the jury doesn't know Jen McCabe or any of the previous testimony or how her demeanor was so different. So, to them, I think this was probably a very impactful testimony. Just a small-town mom who lost her friend and just wants to help everyone and has nothing to hide. But remember that quote I started the episode with? Cross-examination is the greatest legal engine ever invented for the discovery of truth. And it was during cross where some truth came out. We'll be right back after this. Cross-examination of Jen McCabe started out very different than the cross we saw of Jen McCabe in the past. Jen was combative, defensive, and wouldn't answer any questions about anything that she previously said before asking Jackson to see the transcript of what she previously said. But this time, Jen's cross started out where it was almost like she was trying too hard to be nice. Every question Jackson asked, she was just apologetic. Like one of those old sitcoms where two people who hate each other are overly considerate of each other all of a sudden. You go first. Oh, no, you. No, you, I insist. No, you. I'm sorry. Jackson brings this up, asking Jen if she was coached or told to change her demeanor. Maybe try a softer approach.
What about any discussion about your demeanor and how you performed in the last proceeding? I'll ask it a different way. What about your demeanor? I'm using probably a poor word, perform, mm-hmm. how you came across, your demeanor in the last proceeding. Did you discuss changing your demeanor in any way, shape, form, or fashion from the last trial to, I'm sorry, the last proceeding to this trial, my mistake. From the last proceeding to this trial, was your demeanor ever discussed?
No, I was just told to slow down, answer the question, and answer it to the best of my memory.
Was there any discussion about talking about your background, for instance, your family and your children and being a sports mom, as you talked about in your direct examination?
No, I believe I did that in the previous one as well.
Was there any discussion about crafting your testimony in any way to suggest a softer approach?
No.
Jackson said what most of the rest of us were already thinking. He said the quiet part out loud. He also later asked her if she was instructed to be so incredibly apologetic.
No, I'm sorry.
There's that apology again. Has someone told you that you need to apologize when there's an uncomfortable question that you don't want to answer?
No.
Have you discussed this with anybody?
No, and that's not an uncomfortable question. I'm fine to answer it.
How many times did you say, I apologize yesterday in cross-examination?
I didn't count.
Probably more than 15, right?
I have no idea. I'm just trying to answer the questions and be truthful as I can.
Jackson also asked Jen about discussing the case with Carrie Roberts, wanting to ask about their independent memories versus the story that they've put together after forming a timeline and talking about things.
We've discussed what happened that moment,
right,
and in those moments. So, when I got a phone call, and that's my story, that's my, I got a phone call in the morning, and then Carrie can say, yeah, I got a phone call as well.
As you said, that's your story, correct?
Not my story. It's the truth. It's the truth.
Okay.
Now, we weren't far into Jen's cross-examination before a recess was called, and something happened in the courthouse. Brennan calls Jackson and Jen McCabe into a back room, along with other prosecutors, Lally and Ms. McLaughlin, and closes the door. Now, I'm not sure how much time passes, but Jen McCabe then leaves with Ms. McLaughlin. After that, the judge says she wants to see the lawyers and immediate family only, and the court clerk tells all the media that they have to leave. So the O'Keefes walk in the courtroom, and then the court officers tell everyone waiting outside in the hall they all have to go to the first floor. They kick them off the floor. Karen's parents leave the courtroom too, and everyone is sent downstairs. There's no word of what's happening until finally Hank Brennan is out of the courtroom, entering the DA's office with John's brother, Paul O'Keefe. Then Paul leaves the DA's office. After that, Brennan. And then everyone just goes back upstairs with nothing else said and no explanation. But the family of John O'Keefe were noticeably in different seats when they came back. And reporter Christina Rex noted that after lunch, the court officers asked Paul O'Keefe to move to the back row in the courtroom instead of the front, which he did. There's no confirmation on what happened, but sources inside the courthouse have said that there were some faces potentially being made by Paul O'Keefe toward Karen, and it was reported to the judge. Now, this is nothing new. Paul's angry glares at Karen have been a huge topic of discussion since the last trial, and during multiple pretrial hearings as well. In an interview, Paul said he sits right there by Karen intentionally. He wants her to know that she isn't done yet. Now, after all that, Alan Jackson resumes his cross of Jen McCabe. Jackson goes over the family tree, including, of course, the Alberts. He lays out all of their ties to each other, their ties to various law enforcement agencies, and how close their family is, making it clear that they're a close-knit family with ties to Boston Police, Canton Police, the Select Board, State Police. But then, he notes, Karen Reed is not part of that family. Now, right after establishing the connections that Jen has to all of these local law enforcement agencies, Jackson brings up another law enforcement agency. Although the jury isn't allowed to know he's talking about the feds, but we know. And for the first time, we hear that when they came to visit Jen, not only did she lie, but it also went very differently than all of her interactions with the local cops that she knows.
Actually, they walked up to my car. I thought they were, like, selling something, so I was like, oh, no, I'm not the homeowner.
Jen denies being Jen McCabe, claiming instead that her name is Nicole. She goes inside, and then the agents call her, letting her know who they are, and telling her that they need to speak to her. Jen agrees, but says she needs 10 minutes to, quote-unquote, get ready. Jen did allow the agents in. The agents told Jen that it's a crime to lie to them, even in an interview. But apparently, it didn't last long after that. Jen said the interview was brief. That was her word. And then she said she felt uncomfortable answering any other questions, and she wouldn't answer anymore.
I said, I'm going to stop, and I'm going to seek some counsel, yes.
During the brief interview, Jen's husband Matt arrived home, and as the agents were leaving, they asked Jen if she had contacted anyone during that 10 minutes that she asked for to get ready. Jen told them that she contacted her husband, which is why he came home, and that she called Carrie Roberts. Jackson asks about Jen contacting Carrie Roberts, especially given this timeline that they worked on together and the testimony that we heard from Carrie last week about the false statements to the grand jury when she admitted that she had not, in fact, heard Karen ask Jen McCabe to Google how long to die in the cold. But Jen says it's no big deal.
There's nothing more than me calling and saying, hey, did they come to your house? That's what we did when the media showed up, when Ms. Reed's private investigator showed up. We just give each other the heads up, hey, somebody's coming. Because we're just like normal moms. We're not used to this.
Jackson says if they were telling the truth, there would be no reason to contact each other and inquire about what was said. But Jen disagrees.
There's no inquiring. It's like when you're a little, when the ice cream truck was at the street next door and I'm saying, did the ice cream truck come? It's really that simple.
Ice cream truck, federal agents, Tomato, tomato. Jackson objects when Jen begins this narrative, and the judge makes what seems to me a wildly inappropriate comment.
So, you asked a question.
Not about my screen, John.
An argumentative question, and she responded in kind. Next question.
Thank you.
Telling an attorney you asked an argumentative question and she responded in kind in front of the jury is wild. Jackson goes on to ask Jen about the interaction with these agents. Side note, he does keep slipping up and saying agents, but he corrects himself. She told them she called her husband and she told them she called Carrie Roberts, and they asked, did you call anyone else?
They asked you, was there anyone else that you contacted in that 10-minute period before we got a chance to talk to you? Mm-hmm. And your answer was no, correct?
Correct.
And that was a lie, correct?
It wasn't a lie, no.
Was it true?
Was it the truth
or a lie?
Jackson pushes Jen on telling the agents that she didn't contact anyone else. Now, as it turns out, she had also contacted Peggy O'Keefe, the district attorney's office, and Brian Albert. But she didn't tell the agents about any of those. And when asked why she didn't tell the agents about those, Jen said she forgot. But she didn't need those 10 minutes to get ready so she could make all of these phone calls. She said she just needed to brush her teeth. She hadn't done that yet. Jackson looks as he's reading off of some kind of report, and he asked Jen about calling the agents back to tell them that she actually did call other people, aside from the one she told them about.
Did you call them back and say, I'm calling you back because my husband told me that I lied to you and I better clear that lie up?
Jen says she didn't lie. She just forgot that quick.
I had forgotten who I had called.
And all of a sudden you had an epiphany right after they walked out the door?
Yes.
Well, thank goodness for epiphanies, I guess. Another topic that Jackson tried to really pin down is the Jeep parking situation. Now, we'll hear more about this as the trial goes on, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it yet. I'd rather just compare what everybody says. But Jen McCabe says that she remembers Brian Higgins' white Jeep parked in front of the mailbox. Other witnesses have said that it wasn't there at that time, but we also know that he had not left yet. So keep in mind, where the cars are parked has an impact on how far back Karen could have gone if she reversed to hit John O'Keefe, like the prosecution says. So we haven't heard the end of this, but I don't want to spend too much time on it yet until we hear the testimony from everybody else. Now, Jen also described seeing Karen's SUV when she looked out the window while at Fairview, although she works really hard to avoid some questions about when she sent text and when she looked outside. Based on her testimony before and her previous statements, she looked outside 3 to 4 times minimum, but it took 12 minutes of questioning just to get her to acknowledge that or accept that this time when being asked. They continue the talk about Jen looking outside, and Jen says she remembers seeing tire tracks, but never saw a body in the yard, even when they were leaving. She says she never heard any tire screeching or screaming, no loud noises, no signs of any kind of impact, no evidence of any kind of car collision of any kind, and no bodies in the yard. Now, all of this evidence is during the second day that Jen is on the stand, but it's the first day that she's dealt with cross-examination. She's working really hard to avoid answering even the simplest questions. And even when Jackson has transcripts and hands them to her, she still says, nope, doesn't refresh my recollection. Over and over again, she continues to say that she doesn't know what she testified to before or what she may have said before, but she knows for a fact what her testimony is today, even when it's different than what she said before. The entire line of questioning seems to be like pulling teeth, an uphill battle that Jen McCabe is determined to win. Although Jen continues to belabor each question, refusing to have her memory refreshed on anything she previously said, there were 2 points that Jackson was able to get out before the end of day 7. One is how Jen's story has changed about what she was able to see at Fairview when they arrived and found John. Jackson needs to make this point to the jury because this goes along with his theme that they all keep changing the stories to fit the narrative, even when they've said different things before. In the first trial, Jen was very descriptive in what she was able to see once she got out of the car.
I was on the passenger side, so as I got out, she was already at John.
And when she gets over there, what, if anything, could you see at that point?
She straddles John, and she lifts up his shirt, and then she lifted up her shirt and went to lay on him. And Miss Roberts went over, and she was removing the snow from his face.
But this year, Jen testified that it was whiteout conditions, and she couldn't see John on the ground. She couldn't see anything until she got very close up.
When you got out of the car, did you look towards the area of the flagpole?
Yes.
Could you see anything at that point?
No.
How close did you get to the area of the flagpole before you could first actually see something?
Well, I saw the shadowy figures of Carrie and Karen, and it wasn't until I got very close over to them that I saw Carrie removing the snow from John's face.
This may seem like a small detail, but by changing the story to say that she couldn't see anything, it supports the narrative that Brennan is pushing that Karen must have known where John was, since she saw him and ran over to him, and Jen now couldn't see anything. Now, the other point that he was able to make was something else that he pointed out last year. Jen testified that she heard Karen say, "I hit him 3 times. She's very clear about this now. Now, Jen also testified to that in the last trial, but Jackson points out that Jen gave multiple police interviews, and those reports say that Jen told them Karen said, "Could I have hit him? Did I hit him?" Jen now says those police reports are not correct, and she told Proctor in length that Karen said that, so they must not have put it in their reports. Pretty important thing to leave out. Then Jackson brings up Jen's grand jury testimony. More than 227 pages in the transcript. And Jackson hands it to Jen on the stand.
Ms. McCabe, turn to the page or pages in that transcript where you recount to the grand jurors that my client said, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him."
This is over 227 pages.
Take your time.
I about fell out of my chair when Jackson said, "Take your time." Because here's the thing. There's no page that says that because Jen never said that. And Jackson just wanted to make that point to the jury. 12 times Jen McCabe testified about what was said. And 12 times she said that Karen asked, "Could I have hit him?" It wasn't until the last trial that anyone heard Jen say that Karen said, "I hit him." Once again, the story changes to fit the narrative, which is what Jackson was trying to show. And while much of day 7 was spent trying to pull answers out of Jen McCabe, who refused to answer questions or even acknowledge anything that she's previously said, day 8 was a totally different story. There was no court on Thursday, but Friday morning, Jackson came back refreshed with a new approach. And what happened was, well, the most explosive day we've had in court yet. We'll be right back after this.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tantandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Watching Jen McCabe's direct testimony was interesting. It was very different Jen McCabe than we've seen before, prompting defense attorney Alan Jackson to even ask her if someone coached her on how to change her demeanor for this trial. Watching Alan Jackson's cross-examination of Jen McCabe on day 7 was a little bit of a struggle. Jackson worked to impeach Jen McCabe, but she intentionally did everything she could to avoid questions, and Judge Cannone seemed to be protecting her, which was really weird to see. Not how court proceedings that I've seen usually go. With every question, when Jen was presented with things that she previously said, she would just avoid answering, dancing around, giving any kind of affirmative, but also not denying anything. And even when presented with her own words, she would say she doesn't remember. Seeing her own words from even just 11 months earlier doesn't refresh her recollection. She just has her version today that she says she knows. Now, while it seems that Jen wanted to avoid getting caught in any kind of impeachment on the stand, Jackson changed up his approach for day 8, and it seems like he got some of the results that he was looking for. He begins the day jumping right into questioning Jen about the text that she sent to John at 12:45 while she was at Fairview. So here's the point on this one. This is from the report for the interview that Jen did with Trooper Kathleen Prince and Connor Keefe. The report says that Jen told them she texted John at 12:45, then observed the SUV drive away. This information was then used on the probable cause affidavit, which is used to give probable cause to charge Karen Reed. Then it was brought up when Jen testified at the grand jury in 2023, where she again confirmed it. In the last trial, Lally even mentioned it in his openings.
Around 12:45 in the morning, when the vehicle was in front of the residence on Fairview, that for some perceptible period of time, that vehicle travels over 60 feet in reverse at approximately 24.2 miles per hour.
So what changed? Phone data. We now know that Karen Reed connected to John O'Keefe's Wi-Fi at 12:36 a.m., almost 10 minutes before Jen McCabe said that she saw them driving away, which means Jen McCabe's statement couldn't be true. The Commonwealth has changed their theory to accommodate this inconvenient information, but Jackson wants the jury to hear this, so he asked Jen about it. Jen knows this can't be true, and she wants to avoid acknowledging that. So she dances around it, saying that she wasn't paying close attention to time, she was going back and forth, etc. But if you weren't paying close attention to time, and you don't know what time it was, why would you give state police very specific times, and then confirm it in a grand jury under oath? So Jackson reads the transcript out loud.
Quote, I don't know if it's my last text or if I did one more. Yeah, 12:45, hello. Because they were still there. Period. Correct?
That's a part of what I said.
And then the question was, so the dark SUV was still outside the house at 12:45. Answer, at 12:45.
Jen once again dances around acknowledging this, saying that she sees what is on the paper about what she said, but she doesn't remember what she said. I think that she thinks that this will prevent Jackson from being able to impeach her. But her words being different now under oath than what she said under oath before is what can impeach her, whether she says she remembers it or not. Now, Jackson moves on to asking about the next morning in Jen's communications. He begins with a simple question. In the police interview you did 3 days after John's death, you told the troopers you spoke to Karen Reed, correct? Now, look, this is common knowledge. This is not a trick question, but even this she won't answer. She says she doesn't remember. She spoke to a lot of officers and says, if you have a report that says that, but I don't know. Jackson hands her the report, she reads it, and then he asks if that refreshes her recollection about what she said. Again, even with something this simple, Jen tries to avoid answering.
Ms. McCabe, did that refresh your recollection as to what you told Trooper Prince?
I know what happened, so I just answered the questions.
Yes or no? Does that refresh your recollection as to what you told Trooper Prince?
Yes.
So after Jackson finally gets Jen to just agree to the simplest things, that her memory is refreshed from the report,
He moves into the questioning about it. Now, Jen told Trooper Prince and Keefe that after Karen called her that morning, she called her sister, Julie Albert, and called Tom Betty, but got no answer. Then, at the grand jury, Jen was asked again who she talked to that morning. Jackson asked Jen what she told the grand jury.
What did you tell the grand jurors about who you called or who you attempted to communicate with in those first few minutes after that 4:53 a.m. call?
I don't know exactly what I said on that day, but I know who I spoke to.
She doesn't know what she said, but she knows who she spoke to. Again, trying to avoid impeachment. It takes 4 more minutes of questioning and Jen avoiding the answer before she finally just confirms that she said she made the 2 calls, one to Julie and one to Tom. Now, Jackson finally points out how difficult she's being, making note that Jen didn't need to see a report when she testified at the grand jury, and she didn't need to see a report or transcripts when the Commonwealth was asking her questions. But now she needs one before she will answer anything with Jackson. And even then, she still won't really answer. The reason Jackson is going over this is because he wants to show that every time Jen McCabe has been asked about who she contacted that morning, she said her sister Julie and Tom Betty, but there was no answer. But Jackson says there's another call that Jen made, one that she didn't tell anyone about, and one that was apparently missed during the last trial. On day 8, we hear for the first time that Jen McCabe also called Nicole Albert at 5:07 a.m., and that call lasted 38 seconds. This is new information. Jen has never said that before, that she talked to her sister. They both had the same story that they didn't speak that morning until Jen went and woke them up. So how did the call last for 38 seconds if she didn't answer? And why did Jen not tell anyone that she called Nicole also? Jen says when she was asked, it was just a blur. The morning was chaotic and she didn't think about it until later. But Jackson points out, you also left it out during grand jury testimony. And that wasn't just in a fog in that day. Then Jen gets defensive. And less than 45 minutes into day 8, the entire mood shifts.
And at that grand jury, you also left out the fact that you contacted your sister, correct?
There's nothing nefarious. I remembered who I called. I didn't go back and look at phone records.
I didn't say it was nefarious. Why would you use the word nefarious?
Because there's nothing about me calling my sister that is nefarious, and I feel like you're insinuating it might be, and it's not.
Did you use that word because it sounds nefarious?
No, I just used the word because I think that's how you're trying to portray something that is nothing.
Or did you use that word because you think that's how it's coming across? That's nefarious. Without contacting 34
period. No, not at all.
My first thought when I heard this was, well, first of all, why does she pronounce it the same way that Hank Brennan did? Nefarious instead of nefarious. My second thought was that Jen just jumped to that call or not telling anyone about that call as nefarious in front of the jury, and Jackson wasted no time making sure that he stayed on that for a moment. Jackson works his way through other inconsistent statements. Jen testified that Karen Reed just showed up at her house, but Proctor's report says that Jen told Karen to come there. And Jackson brings this up, but Jen denies it, saying that there was never a plan for Karen to come to her house. Jackson asks if she wants to refresh her memory by looking at Proctor's report.
Would it refresh your recollection to look at a police report that he drafted on that issue?
Well, those are his words or summary.
That's not my question. I know these are his words. He wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, would it refresh your recollection about what you told him to take a look at his report?
I know what happened, and I know what I told him. I don't know what's written in that report.
Yes or no?
I don't need to see the report, no.
Jackson also brings up the inconsistencies in the story about when Karen Reed mentioned her cracked taillight to Jen McCabe. Jen and Matt McCabe gave almost identical testimonies in the last trial. The details were so similar that, to me, it came across as kind of scripted. Like, down to the peanut butter in the back seat jokes, and Matt wanting a snack when they got home, and Jen wanting to watch a show that he didn't want to watch. Those aren't the kinds of details that two people would both recall, in order, 2 years later. But part of their matching testimonies was this new version of events where Karen first told Jen about the cracked taillight when she called that second time and Jen and Matt were still in the bedroom. Now, this would change the timing of when Karen first mentioned it, making it before she backed into John's car, which is how the defense has said she cracked her taillight. So it's another new detail added to maybe try to debunk the defense. Jen says she's sure it happened that way, but is she as sure as she was that she saw Karen's SUV drive away at 12:45? Jen says she told Proctor this, so if he didn't put it in his report, that's pretty much just on him. Jackson moves on to Jen's description of the taillight in Proctor's report. The description of the taillight has changed from witnesses over time as well. Carrie Roberts testified last year that the taillight was cracked and had a little black hole in it. But this year, Brennan shows her a picture of the taillight almost completely missing, the condition that it was in when it was in the Sallyport days later, and Carrie says, yep, that's accurate. Now, this isn't a little black hole. So, Jackson also points out that Jen told Proctor it was cracked, and that was it. Now, her version is also worse.
And what you told Trooper Proctor on that day is that you, quote, saw a crack in it. Is that right?
I believe I said it was broken and cracked, and it was missing pieces.
Isn't it true that what you actually said is, we got out at John's house and looked at the taillight, back right taillight, saw a crack in it, correct?
I said that I saw it, and it was cracked, and it was missing pieces.
Jackson asked Jen if she was aware that Proctor was taking notes as she was talking to him in the interview, writing down what she said.
Have you ever seen those notes?
No.
Do you remember exactly the words you used in describing that taillight to Trooper Proctor as you sit here today?
Again, the taillight was cracked and missing pieces.
Okay, I know that's what you're testifying to today, Ms. McCabe. We're all aware of that. You've said it four or five times now. What I'm asking you is, what did you tell Trooper Proctor on January 29th? That's my question. Do you remember the exact words you used to him on the 29th?
I believe I said it was cracked and missing pieces.
Do you know that, or are you guessing?
I'm not guessing.
Okay. Do you remember that specifically?
I remember describing it as cracked and missing pieces.
Do you remember saying it had a crack, or she saw a crack in it?
I do not remember saying that, no.
Would it refresh your recollection to look at a copy of his notes?
Those are his notes.
Ms. McCabe, we can do this all day. Would it refresh your recollection to look at a copy of his notes? If it wouldn't, just tell us.
No, it wouldn't.
Okay.
So once again, Jen remembers something very specific when it supports that narrative, but she can't remember anything when it's something that doesn't support it. Proctor is literally writing down what she's saying as she's saying it and putting it in his notes, but she's still positive that she said this other version that he didn't write in his notes. And seeing the notes of what he's writing as she's talking would not refresh her memory. That comes across to me as a witness who wants to stick to the story, not as a witness who's trying to give the most honest testimony based on memory. We'll be right back after this. The defense has really been highlighting all the evidence that points toward this being a coordinated cover-up, and that includes entering some evidence that paints a picture of what was going on during those hours and days after John's death. So on the night of January 29th, Jen McCabe is texting with her sister, Nicole, and she tells her about Carrie Roberts talking to the police.
Can you read for the jurors what you texted to your sister at 7:54?
Sure. Carrie talked to the cops and kept it simple.
Who's Carrie?
Carrie Roberts.
Now, this isn't a text that I heard in the last trial, and by itself, it wouldn't sound so shady, but paired with everything else, it's an odd thing to say, but also a little confusing. So here's the thing. I have a master timeline where I keep all of the dates and times of everything that I found that's been entered as evidence or mentioned in a trial or a hearing. And I see the interview that Carrie did at 5:25, where she spoke to Trooper Matthew Dunn and Trooper DeChico. And I added the text from Jen to Nicole about Carrie talking to the police and keeping it simple. But I don't see any communication between Carrie and Jen in between that. Which makes me wonder, how did Jen know Carrie talked to police and kept it simple? The kept it simple thing was just interesting to me. So I began looking at their other communication. Now, Jen and Carrie are on the phone for about 8.5 minutes, starting at 5:16. Jen called Carrie as soon as she hung up on a call with Brian Albert, who she spoke to briefly. Jen and Carrie talked on the phone from like 5:16 until pretty much right when Carrie's interview with Trooper Dunn and Trooper DeChico started at 5:25. So if I'm the defense, I would be pointing this out. This could support what they've been saying. Think about it like this. 15 minutes before Karen's car arrives at the Sallyport, Brian Albert calls Jen and tells her to make sure that Carrie just keeps it simple. Don't give any details yet. We'll get it figured out soon. So Jen hangs up and calls Carrie, coaching her on exactly that. Keep it simple for now. We'll get together and figure out details and make a timeline. We'll get it all straight later. After we do that, then you can go into more. And I'll make sure I'm there with you. Just come to my house. We can do it here. And Carrie never talks to police on her own again. It's always with Jen, and it's all based on the timeline. At that point, it's no longer simple. It's curated. And that theory still works, even if there are calls in between those two. But that's the whole thing that really got me thinking. And then, during Jackson's questioning of Carrie, he pointed out on the report from that interview that the troopers told Carrie to tell them everything that would be helpful. They weren't pressed for time, and if there's anything that she thought of, they said contact them. But she apparently kept it simple. And she didn't mention Karen saying anything about John being dead on that 5 a.m. phone call, and she didn't say anything about the cracked taillight. There were a few things she didn't tell them or mention. Keep it simple. But a few days later, on February 1st, there's a group text with Jen and her husband, plus Brian and Nicole Albert. And a text comes in the group chat just before 1 p.m., letting them know that Channel 4 is in Chris Albert's pizza place. Now, the group all perks up over this, everyone with kind of different instructions. Matt McCabe wants someone to tell Chris to ask some questions and tell them the guy never went in the house. In other words, find out what they know and give them what you want them to know. Nicole wants someone to ask what the deal is. And then a couple hours later, Jen McCabe lets the group know that Carrie's over there at the house right now working on a timeline. Proctor was on the phone, and Jen says in the group chat that they handed it over to Carrie, and she's telling them everything in all caps. And then she says, all the stuff. She's not keeping it simple anymore. She's worked on a timeline with Jen, and now she has all these extra details to give police that she didn't have before. Details that would have been important to note in the first interview, but they were never mentioned. Matt tells the group, if Karen pleads out, it will end. If she fights, it will be an episode. He tells them that Carrie could write a book. She's nonstop. Jen says, I love it. And again says she's telling them everything. Nicole says for Jen to call her and Brian after it's over. About 2 hours later, Karen Reed is arrested. So this could all go directly toward what the defense is saying. Keep it simple until she was able to get the info from Jen. And then all of a sudden she's talking nonstop and giving a bunch of new details. While Jen and Matt are listening and reporting back to the group excitedly about Karen telling them everything, all the things, it doesn't look good. I want to go back to that first conversation. Right after Jen tells Nicole that Carrie kept it simple, Nicole tells Jen to get some sleep and they'll talk tomorrow. Jen asks if there's any updates, and Nicole tells her that they'll get more info tomorrow. Don't want to text about it. Now, the only time that you don't want to text about something is when you don't want it in writing. Jen responds, right. And Nicole tells her to text her in the morning or if she hears anything later. So what was happening the next day that they didn't want to text about? Carrie Roberts and Jen McCabe both testified about this. Carrie says she picked up Jen at her house. She had her son and her daughter with her, although Jen never mentions Carrie's son being with them, only the daughter. So maybe she forgot or misunderstood. Either way, they go to the O'Keefe's house where there's a get-together of loved ones, family members, and the car repair guy. Then they leave. They're both very clear about what happens next. Here's Jen McCabe on direct.
We were heading home, but then we ended up dropping off her daughter at her friend's house.
And was Carrie's daughter friends with any of the Lanks?
Yes, Carrie's daughter's good friends with Mike Lank's daughter.
And Jackson clarifies this again on cross.
want to be very clear about this, that you went from One Meadows, the O'Keefe residence, John O'Keefe's residence, directly to Michael Lank's residence, which is in another neighborhood in the same town, correct?
Yes, we went, correct.
And you indicated that you were there to drop off one of Carrie's daughters. Is that right?
Yes.
So they were on the way home from the O'Keefe's and just swung by Lank's to drop off a kid. But they hung out there in the driveway for a little more than 45 minutes, and Jen ran in the house to use the bathroom once. Jackson asked Carrie Roberts if they went straight to Lank's or if they stopped by 34 Fairview.
Did anybody stop by or go by 34 Fairview during that roundabout?
No.
Nobody stopped off at 34 Fairview either on the way or on the way back?
No. I don't believe so. That wouldn't be the route in which to get to my house.
Right. Exactly.
And Jen McCabe testified last year that they didn't stop by Fairview. Maybe they drove by on the way, but they didn't stop or anything. But Jackson brings in location evidence, and suddenly everything about dropping by Lank's on the way home is proven to be false. Jackson has Jen McCabe read the location data of her phone on the stand. She leaves her home at 12:13 p.m., arrives at the O'Keefe's at 12:19. They stay there for about 5 hours and then leave. Now, this is the time when they both said that they swung by Lank's on the way home to drop off Carrie's daughter. But here's the problem. Jen's location data shows that they actually went back to Jen's house. They were only there for about 7 minutes. Then they went to Fairview Road, and they were there for about 4 or 5 minutes. And then they go to Lank's. Both Carrie and Jen said that they went straight from John's to Lank's. They denied going to Fairview and didn't say anything about going to Jen's. That doesn't look good for either of them, especially since Jackson specifically asked each of them, and they both denied it. Of course, you usually don't ask a question you don't know the answer to. But here's the thing. If they had not gone back to Jen's before going to Lank's, it could make sense that they just drove by Fairview, because you can take that route on the way to Lank's. But they went back to Jen's, and Lank's house is like in between Jen's house and 34 Fairview. So they literally had to pass Lank's Road to get to Fairview, then stop there for a few minutes, and then go to Lank's. Then also deny it. Now, if these witnesses are just innocent of everything, they're doing a terrible job at making it look like it. Jackson pushes the issue, and Jen McCabe finally says, well, they just went by there. They didn't stop. They just drove really slow.
We drove by and stopped, yes. Slowly stopped, yes.
You went in the house and spoke with someone?
No, I never went in the house.
Why'd you come go by and just stop?
I think Carrie and I just went by to like take a look at it. We were still trying to figure everything out.
So Jackson points out that her story has changed on this. Here's the thing. Jen didn't tell anyone she went by Lank's house. It wasn't until the defense figured it out that she was confronted with it. And even then, she originally said no, then changed it to, oh, yeah, actually, we did go there. Then she was asked about going to Fairview first, and it's, no, we didn't. Then it's, oh, well, we drove by, since now you can see that we drove by. And now you have the timing on it. Oh, well, I mean, we just drove by really slow. So kind of like stopping for a few minutes, but not really stopping. The story literally evolves as she's presented with evidence. It's not a good look for a witness. Jackson makes a few more points for the jury, like the amount of calls between Jen and Proctor, listing each of them out. They go back and forth about Jen's Google search, which she still says was made in the morning, and that Karen asked her to. Jackson asked Jen if she's aware that Carrie now denies hearing that, but Jen said she didn't know. Jackson also makes a big deal about something that the whole world has been wondering from the start. If you're trying to get help, why not get Brian? He asks if she knows any first responders trained in life-saving measures who live on the street or even on the property. And Jen agrees, yeah, that would be Brian. Jackson also asked Jen about going into the house. Was she not worried about anything? Since there's a dead Boston cop in the yard, there's a Boston cop inside, there's all this commotion, they're not coming out. Did you not worry if they were okay? Jen says she wasn't worried about her sister when she didn't come out. Jackson's like, oh, you just solved the whole crime right there. But then he says what the defense believes is the reason why Jen wasn't worried about her sister.
The reason you didn't go inside the house is because you knew better. You knew better. You knew she wasn't in peril. You knew that Brian Albert wasn't in peril. You weren't worried at all about them, were you?
I was not worried at all because something happened on the front lawn that had nothing to do with anything inside that house.
You weren't worried about them at all because you knew what really happened, didn't you?
So Proctor's report was wrong, Tully's report was wrong, Lank's report was wrong, phone records are wrong, Cellebrite is wrong, ARCA biomechanical engineers are wrong, but Jen is right. Now, during redirect, Brennan reads some texts that he says show Jen's state of mind. There are texts where Jen is saying she sees John every time she closes her eyes, and she's sick to her stomach. She's in shock and devastated for the O'Keefe family. He goes through multiple conversations, but the thing is, none of those texts that were read were to that little group chat, the Albert family, and that's kind of the point. Brennan also brings up Jen not seeing anyone else come out of their home that morning on Fairview Road to see what was happening in the Albert's yard, although we have seen pictures that one of the neighbors took. And then Brennan makes a point that Jen has never refused to talk to law enforcement. She's always been incredibly cooperative and always talked to them. But is that true? Jen never shied away from talking to law enforcement officers that she knows, the ones she has connections to, like Canton PD and state troopers. But when it came time to talk to the feds, where Jen has no control or connections, she lied to them about who she contacted and then answered questions for only a few minutes before saying that she was uncomfortable answering any more questions and wanted to seek counsel. And when Jackson brings this up, Jen McCabe said something that almost made me fall out of my chair.
I welcomed them in my house, sat with them, and then I stopped, and then I met with them a few times after, and I answered all their questions that they asked. I helped clear up some misconceptions that they had been told, and as you know, I know they're no longer investigating, so I think I helped them well.
Jen McCabe was on the stand for 3 days. For 3 days, she tried to convince everyone that the defense is wrong. She's not some kind of mastermind who is controlling a narrative, getting her story out there and manipulating an investigation to steer it away from her and her family. 3 days on the stand going over this, and then 4 minutes before she's let go, she basically admits to doing everything the defense has been accusing her of doing all along, except she admits to doing it with the feds, giving her side of the story to clear up anything that could point toward her or her family, making sure that it all points right back to Karen Reed. Week 2 was definitely full of some big moments. But of all the big moments this week, that one definitely took the cake. And with all this drama happening so early in the trial, I can only imagine what week 3 will bring.
My name is Brandy Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.